I think I talk loud enough. I'm trying to do better. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals afternoon second session. We have one argument on our docket, six cases total being submitted today, but the other three of them are non-oral. Sarah Rowland?
Yes, ma'am.
And Andrea Simmons?
Yes, ma'am.
You ready?
Yes, ma'am.
I'll ask our Chief Deputy Clerk, Megan, to call the case.
The court has now called the case to this day. Ms. Sarah Rowland, Arthur Brett Helen, and Ms. Andrea Simmons, Arthur Brett Helen.
Ms. Rowland?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Ms. Simmons, I am here for appellant John Hankins, and we have three major points of error that we raised in our brief, one being the sufficiency. It's the other two I want to spend the majority or all of my time actually talking about. And the first is from issue number three or point of error number three, and that's whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in denying appellant's motion to suppress. And then issue five, whether the trial court abused its discretion in refusing to give a definition of operating in the jury charge during the guilty, not guilty portion of the trial pursuant to appellant's specific request. First of all, with regard to the motion to suppress hearing, there were basically two main theories or routes the state chose to take or could have taken during that motion to suppress hearing. The first being whether or not there was probable cause to believe appellant was operating the vehicle while intoxicated when he was stuck in the mud in the ditch. The second, whether or not there was probable cause to believe he was operating while intoxicated prior to being stuck in the ditch. As you know from the hearing on the motion to suppress, basically the evidence there was a police officer was dispatched out to a vehicle that was stuck in the ditch, arrived, and then appellant gets out of the truck, and that's pretty much it as far as the facts go there. With regard to the motion to suppress and appellant specific arguments, you have to look at the motion to suppress and the evidence there regarding operating through the prism of a legally correct definition of operating. And that's the common thread through the motion to suppress point of error and the jury charge point of error that we're talking about. And operating, while it may have at one time had an ordinary usage, back in 1995, it was first defined by the Court of Criminal Appeals in Denton versus State. And there it was defined that operating means to take action to affect the function of a vehicle in a manner that would enable the vehicle's use. That's been since 1995 the definition, and that's still the definition today. In determining what specific actions affect the functioning of a vehicle in a manner that would enable the vehicle's use, this Court of Appeals and courts of appeals throughout Texas have overwhelmingly relied on instances where a person has engaged the vehicle's transmission, has actually taken a step to enable the vehicle's use, just like the definition in Denton. In this case, the evidence at the suppression hearing simply does not support the fact that there was any kind of operating going on when the car was stuck in the ditch.
Question.
Yes, ma'am.
Does the record reflect the position of the car in the ditch or where the ditch was, or was it a steep drop-off, or do we just know that it's a ditch?
The record just reflects that it's a ditch, that it was near a driveway, and the record reflects that it was stuck in the ditch, that it's unknown whether or not the car was in any kind of gear, but that there were no lights on. Nobody had to remove it from gear, that it actually had to be towed out of where it was. So it was literally stuck in a ditch. that's as much evidence as we have there.
Thank
yes.
you. I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Whether there was, what evidence was there about how dispatch learned of the vehicle's location and that someone was sitting in it?
Someone called, the evidence was that someone called in and said a vehicle is stuck in the ditch. There was no evidence to say someone saw a driver that ran off the road and then got stuck in a ditch. It was just a caller in that said there's a vehicle stuck in the ditch.
Okay.
That's the evidence.
Of, an anonymous
call. Yes, ma'am. No caller testified at a hearing. There wasn't a tape played at the hearing or the trial or anything like that. So literally the evidence at the motion to suppress hearing is police respond to a vehicle stuck in the ditch. They come out. Appellant gets out of the car, out of the driver's seat, and the officer describes him as staggering. That's the sum total of the evidence there. So the problem with regard to operating in the prism and in the context of the motion to suppress hearing is that it's very clear based on Denton versus State, based on other courts of appeals interpretations of the specific definition of operating, that appellant was not operating when he was there in the ditch when the police officer arrived. The second theory now to address that is whether or not appellant was operating while intoxicated prior to getting stuck in the ditch. And the problem there during the motion to suppress hearing and what appellant argued at the trial court and on appeal is that there was absolutely no temporal link and evidence of intoxication at the motion to suppress hearing. And there was basically a complete failure on the state's part to ask the questions necessary and to provide sufficient probable cause for an arrest for driving while intoxicated. There simply was not the question asked, did he appear intoxicated? There wasn't any kind of statement about he sounded that way, he looked that way. The sum total of evidence is that when he got out of the car, he staggered. And so our contention is that under either of those two theories, either probable cause to believe he was driving intoxicated when he was stuck in the ditch, that argument totally fails because there wasn't operating at that point in time, and any kind of argument or contention that he was driving while intoxicated prior to getting stuck in the ditch fails because there was no temporal link between any kind of driving or operation and intoxication. In fact, quite lacking was any evidence of intoxication during the motion to suppress hearing. Did you have a question, Justice Meyer? That testimony was brought out during the trial, and it was in the bed of the truck, sitting upright in the bed of the truck. And that was testimony that was brought out during trial. During
when he got out of the truck, he got out of the truck's cabin and exiting from the driver's side door.
Yes, sir. He got out of actually the interior of the truck.
Have some kind of window that leads through, set that beer out the back, sit there. I mean, I'm just curious. I'm looking at your position that he was drinking while he was in the truck because he had this cold bottle of Budweiser that was half drunk sitting in the truck and hadn't spilled, and so obviously it hadn't been sitting there while the truck was moving.
Yes, sir. Yeah, and that was definitely a point of contention during the trial too. How could it be sitting if the truck stuck in the ditch upright if it wasn't there after he already got there? There was no evidence of any kind of back window in the truck or anything about that at all. The evidence at the trial completely turned on. You wouldn't expect for a bottle of beer to be sitting upright as a car goes into a ditch and gets stuck in a ditch. So necessarily, wouldn't you expect that it would have been placed there afterwards?
So there's no evidence of any additional person being involved in the truck, or riding in the truck, or around the truck,
No, sir. No, sir. There's no evidence of anyone else being around other than the appellant. That's true. That's true. It's true that a police officer can arrest, while it's true that an offense for which there's probable cause to arrest doesn't have to be the same for which the person is arrested, there's no evidence here to suggest that there was probable cause to believe at the point in time of the suppression hearing that appellant could have been arrested for public intoxication or any kind of other offense like the state suggested in its brief. Again, other than the staggering, there's not evidence that appellant in this case was intoxicated, especially to the degree that he was endangering himself or others when the police got there. I think, again, if you look at the record and read actually what happened and what was said at the motion to suppress hearing, what may have happened is everybody assumed intoxication without saying it, without asking the questions, without offering any proof of it. I'm not sure. I know that it's not there in the record, though, in the black and white record. The second issue that I want to focus my attention today on, and kind of the main one, is this jury charge issue. And as you decide this issue, I think it's important that you're aware of, and I'm sure you already are, the PDR that's pending before the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in Kirsch versus State, and that's petition PD 02-4511. And that case is directly on point with what we're dealing with here. In Kirsch, the two questions that the court granted review on are this. Is it necessary to define the term operate in the guilt-innocence jury charge in a DWI case? And the second question, did the Court of Appeals err in approving a definition of operate in the guilt-innocence charge in a DWI case? And Kirsch is a case originally out of the Texarkana Court of Appeals. In that case, the trial court did provide the jury with an instruction of operate. And that was over Kirsch's objection there. But the Court of Appeals found that the definition was unnecessary, but it wasn't erroneous. So the petition for discretionary review, now the question is it necessary? Is it necessary to define that term? And it's not necessary. We all know it's not necessary to define terms that aren't statutorily defined if they have a common understanding. But if a term has acquired a specific legal meaning under the law, then in order to assure that a jury will fairly interpret and apply that law, it's absolutely necessary to define a term. And terms that aren't in the penal code are defined for juries. Constructive transfer is an example of that. That's not defined in the penal code or the health and safety code, but it's defined and has been held to be defined, to be necessary to be defined. And that's a case called Ruiz versus State. Operate in the context, especially of driving while intoxicated, has acquired a specific legal definition. And it began acquiring that specific legal definition back in 1995 when Denton was decided. And you can look and do a search for courts of appeal decisions on operating and what that centers on. And everybody over and over and over again cites Denton and then with specific nuances says what operating is and defines it seemingly on a case-by-case basis. But overwhelmingly, the definition follows Denton, meaning to do something, to take some sort of action to affect the vehicle's functioning. And that's different than what maybe common sense would dictate or what has been dictated. And certainly the Court of Appeals in Texarkana felt it was important enough to be defined for the jury there so that nobody would apply an erroneous definition, be it too broad or too narrow. And now that decision is pending before the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. So I think it's noteworthy that operating has gained so much attention. At the very least, it's gained a tremendous amount of attention. There are unpublished and published opinions on it, and I think it's quite clear that at the very least, folks, juries, lawyers, judges, need some sort of guidance on it to say yes, juries need a definition, or no, they don't, and go back to whatever the common usage is. But I think in this case, because operating was the issue from jury selection on, both the appellant and the state discussed it. When appellant asked for it to be defined, it should have been defined, and the fact that it wasn't caused some harm to him. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to begin first with going over some of the facts of the case because they are extremely relevant to the motion to suppress hearing, and it also addresses a lot of the questions that both Justice Walker and Justice Meyer have asked as well. Counsel started off by saying there were very little facts other than the appellant leaving the vehicle and stumbling. The state would argue, however, there was much more than that, that in fact it was, I believe, about 1:10 in the morning when the officer arrived in response to a 911 call of a one car accident. There wasn't an accident per se. It was the vehicle, the truck at issue, was stuck in a ditch. And officer that responded to the 911 call did answer how the truck was located. There was a main road, which obviously the appellant had been traveling on. Off of that main road was a driveway into a residential home. The appellant's truck was located next to the driveway in the ditch, perpendicular to the road. No tires were on the road, no tires were in the driveway. He had completely left the roadway. The officer stated, based on his training and experience and based on what the appellant said he had been doing that night, that what had happened is the appellant had become disoriented and lost in that residential area, attempted to make a U-turn, missed the driveway. As he made a U-turn in the driveway, he missed the end of the driveway and landed in the ditch. The officer gave that opinion based on appellant stating that he had been working all day for his father, started about noon that afternoon, had drank about 6 beers, and was on his way home. The appellant stated that his job was in Carrollton, and he lived in Carrollton. However, the truck was in a ditch 20 minutes outside of Carrollton, and the appellant appeared to not understand where he was located or that he was no longer in the city of Carrollton. The officer therefore thought that he must have become confused in this residential area, which is not where he lived. When he attempted to make a U-turn, he missed the road. When the officer arrived, the appellant did exit the truck, and he was stumbling as he exited. The officer performed field sobriety tests, all of which the appellant was unable to successfully complete. The officer also then moved on to alphabetical and numerical tests to try to give him another chance at doing those, whereas the appellant could not follow the directions correctly on those tests either. The officer then also smelled an odor of alcohol. After all of that information, he decided he would arrest the appellant on DWI charges. Another officer also came to the scene as the field sobriety tests were being given, and he observed the area around the truck and the truck. There was a beer bottle with some alcohol still in it sitting upright in the bed of the truck. Obviously, it was cold to the touch. There was no information of or testimony or evidence of a window where it could have been placed at. So the only obvious explanation is either that he got out of the vehicle with an open beer, sat it down on the bed of his truck as he looked to try to figure out how he had gotten stuck, or I'm sure appellant would like you to argue or like for you to believe that after he got stuck in the ditch and tried to ponder how he would get out, he decided to have a cold beer. And then placed it in the bed of his truck before he got back inside the truck. Also outside of the truck were several beer bottles or beer cans in addition to a 12-pack case. I think the 12-pack case was Budweiser. Some of the beer bottles were Budweiser, and there were a couple that were Keystone. Appellant was pretty adamant that those Keystone were not his. He doesn't drink Keystone. Budweiser was his. Again, that leaves the inference of, did the beer bottles, did he drink those, open up a 12-pack of beer after he got stuck in the truck, and if so, where did the remainder of the beer bottles go that fit that 12-pack and were not located on the scene? Or did those kind of come out of the truck as after he got stuck in the ditch and worked his way out with a cold one in his hand? The beer bottles on the ground were cold to the touch, too, so they had been recently consumed, and they had not been in the ditch, you know, prior to appellant's arrival. That can be inferred. Therefore, based on all of that evidence, the officer made an arrest for DWI. He was taken to an intoxilizer room in another police station. He was given two tests, both of which came back fairly high. I believe it was 1.65 and 1.68. And retrograde extrapolation testimony came back that put him at above the intoxication level at the time a 911 call would have been made. Based on all of that, the arrest was made. All of this information summarized in the officer's affidavit for probable cause for arrest, which was before the trial court at the motion to suppress. The end of the motion to suppress, the trial court specifically stated that after reviewing the probable cause affidavit, it was apparent that the probable cause existed, that the trial judge felt the only issue that really was of concern was the operation issue, which was what was specifically raised in the motion to suppress by appellant, not intoxication, but solely the issue of operation. And the trial court said that he felt like after reading case laws and hearing evidence and argument, that he felt that the operation fell someplace in the middle. He was going to rule against appellant, but he was going to allow the argument on the record for appellate review purposes and allow the appellant an opportunity to build their record for appeal, which I think kind of explains why there's so much focus in the motion to suppress hearing on operation rather than intoxication, because that was really what appellant was concerned with, and the court already found intoxication to be proven via the affidavit, so no additional testimony was needed.
Counsel, you have a great
hand. I do, sir. Yes, sir.
That's bullet point summaries that you're making of what Officer Carr testified about, correct?
During the hearing, the state called Officer Craver as a sole witness who testified that, yes.
One of them says about number one, two, three, four, number six, he did not have a time frame as to when the appellant drove.
I believe if my memory is correct, you know, it's me trying to be fair in the record, but it was to a lot of questioning from appellant's counsel of, what time did he drive? Did he drive prior? How long had he been in the ditch? Do you know how long he'd been in the ditch? Do you know when he drove the car? And a lot of that comes down to the officer's answer being no, because there was a lot of inconsistent responses from appellant on how long he had been there. It ranged from 10 minutes to 15 minutes to 20 minutes. So each time he told the officer what he was doing there or how he got there, time frames, the officer could not testify that he drove at 1:10 a.m., you know, just right before the 911 call, or if he had been there for half an hour prior to the 911 call.
Or if he'd been there for 2 hours.
Could not testify as he'd been there for 2 hours. I'm trying to remember if I have an exact count. I believe, here it is, 3 bottles of Budweiser, 2 cans of Keystone Light. However...
The 3 bottles you're talking about are empty bottles out on the ground?
Yes, Justice Meyer.
And there was a partial Budweiser in the back of the truck?
I believe that's a separate count than three on the ground, yes.
So if we've been there 20 minutes, he drank three beers and part of another one in less than 20 minutes?
If you believe he consumed the alcohol outside of the vehicle after becoming stuck. Well, there's no testimony as to how long a beer bottle would stay cool after having been purchased at a store at a certain temperature, and then how long it stays cool after having been consumed.
My concern, counsel, is the allegations and the requirements that there be proof that the defendant was operating a vehicle while under the influence of alcohol, and what evidence is there that the operation, I mean, that he was intoxicated while he was operating. I mean, it's clear he was operating, the arguments aside from the vehicle being stuck in the ditch. He operated the vehicle by his own testimony to drive it where it got stuck in the ditch. And so the gravamen of proof on this charge of DWI is that he was operating the vehicle while he was intoxicated. The argument he was drunk when he stumbled out of the truck, but if there's not evidence establishing how long he was there and he had bottles on, a partially consumed bottle sitting up in the back of the truck and bottles on the ground, I mean, I'm having trouble seeing where the proof is that he was intoxicated while he was operating. I mean, I'm understanding that the discussion, the state's view is that he was operating whenever he turned the key on, if he's sitting in there doing nothing more than starting the engine to get the cabin going. I understand the discussions that are in the case law all the way down to the most recent case in this court about what's operating. But I'm worried about operating in the sense of if there was proof of that he was intoxicated when he drove the vehicle.
Okay, I don't want you to be worried. I'm going to take care of this.
All right.
The intoxication is proven by an inference, just as there could be an inference that he got drunk after having gotten the truck stuck. There's an inference that he got drunk before he got the truck stuck. And if we're going to say that he got drunk after the truck was stuck, it appears we're kind of going on his credibility of what he had been doing, and I'd like to follow his credibility along to where he testified that he operated a motor vehicle while intoxicated in response to an officer's question. See, I have that written down.
Looking at the officer's affidavit?
Not looking at the officer's affidavit. I believe it stemmed from testimony from the officer that he had stated he did operate while intoxicated.
It says on page 17, the same place you and I are looking, that the officer's testimony was he did not know when the appellant got stuck in the ditch or how much appellant had to drink, either prior to or after he got stuck.
It is true. The officer cannot give you a timeline. He wasn't present, and there was not a witness to tell us what time he was operating. However, in the record, third volume at page 90, it's direct examination of the arresting officer, and it says, when you got back to the station after the video ended, did you ask the defendant a series of questions? You mean in the intoxilizer room? Answer, yes. Or question, yes. Answer, yes, I did. Question, and did you ask him if he was operating a vehicle? Answer, let me refer to my notes here. Yes, I did. Question, and what kind of vehicle was he operating? Answer, a 1994 S10 Chevrolet pickup. So I think when the trial court who is sitting as the trier of fact in this case, and the legal sufficiency standard gives full play to the responsibility of the trier of fact to resolve conflicts in testimony and weigh evidence, especially in cases like this where it's circumstantial and an inference can go each way, we're to weigh the totality or view the evidence in the totality of the circumstances. We have the officer's testimony about the only time in the entire time frame that is of concern is when did he drive the vehicle? Did he drive it before he was that drunk, after he's drunk, midway, halfway drunk? When did it happen? And the trial court was in the best position to weigh the evidence of the testimony and make an inference. And even if we were to believe the appellant, he states that he told the officer, I operated.
Furthermore, based on the appellant's own testimony that he had been in the ditch at the most for approximately 20 minutes. Talking about the rate of grade extrapolation.
Yes.
And there's no sign to a place to the record there where he said that. Do you know where that is in the record that he said he'd been there only 20 minutes?
Yes, it's in my summary. On page 10 at the bottom, the appellant stated that on a scale of 0 to 10, with 10 being passed out drunk, he was a 12. Then he stated that the truck's engine, he started it about 15 minutes ago to warm it up. Then he said he started it 5 minutes before the officer arrived. And then he said that a woman had stopped to help him and said her husband would show up, but that was 20 minutes ago and no one showed up. So at the most, his was 20 minutes. He appears to say 5, then 15, and then 20. So I think at the most, according to his own statements to the officer, he'd been there for 20 minutes. And again, I would like to ask the court to please review the entire record and the evidence and the inferences, and to please give deference to the trial court's opinion and not act as a 13th juror on the case on the sufficiency and affirm the trial court's judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rowland, do you have the vote?
Yes, ma'am, I do. And I want to start by clarifying, I think we're talking and lumping everything together. There's what was put on as proof and evidence at the motion to suppress hearing. There's what was the evidence at the trial. And I think it's important not to lump all of that together when you're addressing whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in denying appellant's motion to suppress. I think you should look at the evidence that was presented to the trial court for its consideration on the motion to suppress. And that hearing, the sum total of that evidence can be found in the third volume of the reporter's record, pages 5 through 32. And the state's brief on page 17 and going into page 18, Justice Meyer, that you were referring to, that is the evidence that was before the trial court for the motion to suppress hearing. A lot of what the state was talking about was evidence that was admitted during the trial. There was much more evidence admitted during the trial. There were more questions asked. There was a video played. A police officer was cross-examined and questioned about a report that was made. Field sobriety tests were talked about. The problem is, none of that was asked or ever broached at the motion to suppress hearing. And so that's our argument, is that there was a failure of proof there, and because of that failure of proof, there wasn't evidence sufficient for a finding of probable cause that he was driving or operating while intoxicated, and therefore the motion to suppress should have been granted.
Counsel Rowland, I'll ask you then the same thing I asked.
Certainly.
For the state. What evidence is there as to how long your client was stuck in the ditch?
there is evidence during the motion to suppress hearing, and that evidence is 15 minutes. And it doesn't say anything about I've been here 15 minutes. The time frame there is that he had been warming up his truck for 15 minutes.
All right. What about the trial? I don't understand about the suppress hearing.
Yes, sir.
Separate that out, and I want to look at the evidence that was presented of guilt. Where is there in this trial evidence, according to your understanding, any evidence as to how long the defendant was stuck in the ditch?
There's no evidence of exactly how long he was in the ditch. And that's as brief as I can be on that point. The caller, as far as the motion to suppress hearing goes, I want to clarify, too, something I think that may have been misconstrued. As far as the evidence in the motion to suppress hearing goes, the caller said that the vehicle was stuck in the ditch. It never, ever identified the vehicle was moving. There was never anyone who saw the vehicle in motion. There wasn't an affidavit before the trial court. There was no judicial notice of anything. There wasn't a police report that was referred to, a video that was offered or watched or anything. So the problem appellant has is that through assumption, through laziness, through whatever, is that there was a failure to ask the questions. And because of that failure, the trial court should not have denied appellant's motion to suppress. Since there wasn't any kind of evidence of a temporal link, then he should have granted appellant's motion to suppress. And the failure to do that is why we're here today and what we are arguing about. And that's kind of the major ground other than the jury charge issue, and I think that's the one that's got a lot of merit, quite frankly, is the motion to suppress issue. And so I think that without that evidence there, then he should have and he was required to suppress that evidence, and the failure to do so was an abuse of discretion. And if there are no more questions, I'll return the last few seconds to the court.
Thank you both for your very good arguments and briefing. Your case is submitted, and you will hear from us in due time. We appreciate your being here today and your excuse. And we will stand in recess.
All rise. The audience is adjourned.